We will move now to our second case, which is number 072719, Bach Luchterhand against Granite Microsystems. Mr. Lang.
May it please the court. This is a duty to defend case. The district court held that the insurers did not have a duty to defend the appellants in this case because the plaintiff's complaint did not allege an occurrence as that term is defined in the policies. The appellants believe that the district court erred in that ruling, and this morning my argument will explain why. But before doing so, a few general points need to be made. First, insurance policies, like the ones at issue in this case, are drafted exclusively by the insurers. They select the policy language. Second, when the meaning of a policy term is consistently being litigated, it suggests that that term is ambiguous or, at least at a minimum, something less than clear. Third, given the extent of litigation in Wisconsin and elsewhere regarding the term occurrence, one would think that the insurers would redraft the definition of that term to say what they tell insureds and courts they really mean. For example, to define it as an unintentional act regardless of whether the harm is intended. And fourth, because insurers draft their policy language, if it is determined that there is any plausible interpretation of a policy that provides for coverage, the insurer has a duty to defend the insured. Now, moving on to the facts of this case as alleged in the complaint, and there's really four facts that are relevant to this appeal. One, the plaintiff hurt his leg while at work. Two, after doing so, the defendant, Dan Armbrust, the president of the company, drove the plaintiff to a two-hour business meeting. Three, after the meeting, Armbrust helped the plaintiff to the car and then drove him to a hospital. And four, the plaintiff suffered pain and suffering, emotional distress, and embarrassment as a result of having to sit through the two-hour business meeting. Those are the relevant facts as pled for purposes of this appeal. But equally important, it's significant that certain facts were not pled. For example, number one, the plaintiff did not plead that he ever told Mr. Armbrust that he needed immediate medical care. The plaintiff did not plead that he was precluded by Mr. Armbrust in any way from either calling a taxi cab or an ambulance or leaving the meeting at any point in time. Three, the plaintiff did not allege that Mr. Armbrust intended him any harm or intended him any damages as a result of asking him or having him sit through the business meeting. Now, the insurers contend in this case that those facts do not constitute an occurrence because Mr. Armbrust's acts were intentional, even though the harm flowing from those acts was not. And before discussing the Wisconsin law on this issue, I would like you to consider the insurer's argument in the context of the following four scenarios. The first scenario: a driver of a vehicle, while intentionally speeding, crashes into another vehicle. Does the driver's intentional acts constitute an occurrence? or is the driver without any insurance coverage for the accident? The second scenario. A medical doctor intentionally amputates a patient's left leg incorrectly when he was supposed to amputate the patient's right leg. Does the doctor's act, intentional as it was, constitute an occurrence, or is the doctor without coverage for the claim? The third scenario. A landowner intentionally cuts down trees, believing those trees were on his property, but in actuality, they were on a neighbor's property. Does the landowner's intentional acts constitute an occurrence, or is he too without coverage for the claim? And the fourth scenario is a masonry contractor intentionally calculates a slope for a masonry slab and then intentionally pours the slab at that slope, incorrectly believing that that slope will adequately handle drainage, but in fact he was wrong. Is that masonry contractor without coverage as well because of his intentional acts? Now, let's look at the Wisconsin case law as to how it handles these situations. And the first case to deal with the issue is the Patrick case, 1980 case. The facts of that case were the facts I gave you in the third scenario, the landowner cutting down the trees. The plaintiff was the neighbor whose trees got cut down. They sued the defendant. And the claim was intentional cutting of his trees. The court held that an occurrence was alleged. The court focused on the acts and on the harm. And the court concluded that while the acts were clearly intentional, the landowner intended to cut trees, intended to cut those trees. The landowner clearly did not intend the harm, and that is damage to the neighbor's trees. So the court in that case said you look at the harm and you do not look at the nature of the intentional acts to determine whether an occurrence occurred. The Wisconsin courts have in a whole bunch of cases discussed this issue in the context of construction cases. And let me just talk about very briefly about a couple of them. In Kalkthaler, the defendant was sued by the plaintiff for faulty workmanship resulting in some leaking windows. Clearly, the acts of the contractor were intentional, but the harm was not. In American Girl, the defendant was sued for providing faulty site preparation services, resulting in foundation cracks and the building ultimately being torn down. Clearly, the contractor's acts and the advice was intentional, but the harm was not. In 1325 North Van Buren, the defendant was sued for pouring or for faulty workmanship resulting in a whole bunch of defects. And finally, in the Glendinning's limestone case, that's the fourth scenario I gave you above, the defendant was sued for pouring a concrete slab at a particular slope resulting in puddling and poor drainage. In each of those cases, the defendant's conduct was clearly intentional. There's no doubt about it. But in each of those cases, the courts found an occurrence for the same reason. And that is you don't focus on the intentional nature of the acts. You focus on whether the harm was intended. Now, I will acknowledge that the dictionary definitions used in the Doyle case and American Girl case seem to focus on the act and not on the harm. But I would say this. If you read American Girl then, in the very next paragraph, after citing that definition, says this. That's paragraph 38. No one seriously contends that the property damage was anything but accidental. Nor does anyone argue that it was anticipated by the parties. Neither the cause nor the harm was intended, anticipated, or expected. We conclude that the circumstances of this claim fall within the policy's definition of occurrence. If these types of claims are not covered by policies, then insureds would rarely ever have coverage for their normal day-to-day claims. For example, the speeding driver in scenario number one would be without coverage for himself and for the injured party. The careless doctor would have no coverage. The landowner would have no coverage. And the contractor would have no coverage. Insureds like the defendants in this case expect, when they pay high premiums for policies, business policies in particular, that they're going to have coverage for cases like this. You need to keep in mind these things. This is not a situation where Mr. Armbrust punched the plaintiff. It's not a situation where he physically held him hostage at some meeting. It's not a situation where he held a gun to his head and said, "You can't leave." In fact, the opposite is true. The acts alleged by Mr. Armbrust is that he drove the plaintiff to a two-hour business meeting, had the plaintiff attend the two-hour business meeting, and then afterwards was good enough to help the plaintiff to his car and to drive him to a hospital. And those are the very facts that led the district court in this case to say there is no way you can infer any intent to cause harm by Mr. Armbrust to the plaintiff. I see my rebuttal time. My light has gone on, so I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lang. We'll hear now from Mr. Stramp.
Good morning, Your Honor. The insurance contracts at issue in this case that were issued by Federal Insurance Company and Vigilant Insurance Company provide no coverage for the allegations contained in Mr. Lechterhand's complaint. That is true for three reasons. Number one, the allegations of the complaint do not allege an occurrence or a bodily injury caused by an accident. Even if it did, number two, the intentional acts exclusion, or number three, the employer's liability exclusion would preclude coverage. The district court read the complaint, and it's important to remember that the complaint is what the key element is here. The allegations aren't the facts that the opposing counsel brought up. The allegations that are relevant is what's in the complaint. And the district court looked at the complaint and concluded that the defendant's actions, as alleged in the complaint, cannot qualify as occurrences or accidents. And the court came to that conclusion based on several specific things contained in the complaint. And these are very different from the facts that opposing counsel just brought to you. And these are the facts that led the district court to conclude that there is no coverage. For example, in paragraph 19 of the complaint alleges defendants intentionally terminated the plaintiff. In paragraph 22 of the complaint, the allegations say that the defendant intentionally inflicted emotional distress upon Mr. Lechterhand. Paragraph 25 of the complaint states that the defendant intentionally withheld medical treatment and falsely imprisoned Mr. Lechterhand. These are the relevant facts. These are the facts the court looked at when concluding that there was no insurance coverage under the policies. I want to take a minute and discuss the cases that Attorney Lang just brought up. In order to do that, Judge, I think it's important, or Your Honors, it's important to keep in mind the rationale and the definitions that the court used when looking at what is an occurrence and what is an accident. The American Girl case is without a doubt the leading, most recent case in Wisconsin, and I was hoping Justice Sykes would be here since she wrote that opinion. I'm sure she'll have some very good insights on it. But in the American Girl case, the court states very clearly that an accident is an unforeseen incident. An accident is some unexpected or undesirable event. An accident is an event without foresight or expectation. It is not intentional termination of employment. It is not intentional infliction of emotional distress. It's not intentionally withholding medical treatment. The key is, from American Girl, that the unexpected result is not an accident. The means or the cause must be accidental. So what we need to focus at is what actually caused the accident. What actually caused the alleged injury? In this case, the alleged injury was caused by intentional termination, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and intentionally withholding medical treatment. Now, I'll concentrate on American Girl, but the rationale that I'm going to talk about in American Girl applies to almost all of the cases that Attorney Lang just referred to. And in American Girl, there's kind of a three-step process that the court went through when looking at this, is there an occurrence issue? The first question they looked at is, was there some sort of intentional act by the engineer? Just real briefly, American Girl is, engineer does soil calculations and develops a plan to stabilize the soil. Somehow those calculations are done inappropriately. The building that gets constructed ends up collapsing and having significant problems. Well, there's no doubt that the engineer intended to do work on the project. He didn't just accidentally do calculations on the soil. Where he did make a mistake and where the allegations of the accident occur is the calculations he intended to do is not what happened. He somehow made a mistake while making those calculations so that when those calculations were implemented, when the construction is done, the soil is not appropriately stabilized. That creates the property damage, which is the collapse of the building. So there's three steps there. There's an intent to do the engineering work. There's somehow inappropriately doing the engineering work, and then there's the damage to the building. That's not the case here. Here we've only got two steps. What we've got in the complaint is an allegation of intentional termination, intentional infliction of emotional distress, intentionally withholding medical treatment, and as a result of that intentional act, we have an injury. So what we've got in this case, based on the allegations in this complaint, is an intentional act that caused an injury. We do not have this cause that wasn't anticipated. What we've got is the cause is anticipated. The termination is intentional, and because of that, we have an injury, as opposed to the engineer and American Girl not intending to do the calculations wrong and simply having a problem because of that. That same rationale applies to these hypotheticals that Attorney Lang brought up to the court. Specifically, let's talk about the doctor. No one's saying that a doctor intentionally cuts off the wrong leg when he does a surgery. That doctor is intending to cut off the correct leg, and by some mistake, by some sort of an unforeseen incident, he ends up cutting off the wrong leg. That's why there is insurance coverage in that scenario, and that's why there is not insurance coverage for the intentional acts alleged in this complaint. The same thing would be true for the other scenarios, the auto accident. All the time we see cases where people are racing, they're intending to race and they have an auto accident, and there's no coverage for that. Or you see road rage cases where a person intends to collide with another vehicle because, you know, they're mad at them for cutting them off. There's no insurance coverage for that intentional act. And that type of intentional act is exactly the type of intentional act that is alleged in the complaint in this case. Two other occurrence cases that Attorney Lang didn't bring up, I think, warrant some attention from the court. The first one is the Doyle case. The Doyle case, you may remember, involves employees from a radio station and the radio station itself being sued by Doyle. Allegations were that the employees committed some torts against Mrs. Doyle, including wrongfully attaching some of her assets. So the allegations against the employees of the radio station were for intentional acts. Then there was a negligent supervision claim against the radio station. Well, the majority of the court's opinion relates to this negligent supervision claim and whether or not that's an accident. But within that case, the court references the actual intentional acts by the employees. And the court says that those aren't occurrences. Those aren't accidents. And that's exactly what we've got here. The intentional attachment of assets in the Doyle case is no different from the intentional termination, the intentional infliction of emotional distress, the intentional withholding of medical treatment that we have in this case. The other case that Attorney Lang didn't mention that I think is instructive to the court as it relates to this is there an occurrence, is there an accident issue, is the Everson versus Lorenz case. This case involves a real estate transaction. The allegations were that the seller of the property made misrepresentations in the real estate condition report. Specifically, the seller alleged that the property was not in a floodplain. In reality, the property was in a floodplain. Based on that misrepresentation in the real estate condition report, the seller of the property sued. or the seller of the property attempted to get insurance coverage. The court looked at that case and determined that the completion of the real estate condition report was a deliberate act, and that any type of deliberate act is not an accident. Therefore, there wasn't an accident, there wasn't an occurrence in the Everson case. That is a much similar case to the situation we've got here. In Everson, you've got someone intentionally completing the real estate condition report. In this case, you've got allegations of there being an intentional termination of the employment. You've got allegations of there being intentionally withholding medical treatment, and you've got the allegations of the false imprisonment. So, Your Honor, I think if you look at the occurrence cases and you really concentrate on what is the court saying there, you'll notice that in the cases where the court finds that there is an accident, there's this three-step process. There is an intentional act to do some work. There's some mistake while doing that work. And then there's an injury that comes as a result of this work.
You've got the same occurrence language in both the CGL policy and the umbrella policy, but aren't you dealing with some different language in the workers' comp policy?
Correct, Your Honor. And the workers' comp policy does not use the term occurrence at all. It uses bodily injury by accident. Now, because the case law that interprets occurrence, you know, the definition of occurrence is accident, including continuous or repeated exposure to the same thing, all of the case law in Wisconsin that analyzes this analyzes it from a perspective of, is there an accident? And I think the same definitions for accident that we apply when looking at occurrence also apply to that workers' compensation policy when you're determining whether or not there's bodily injury caused by an accident. And that certainly is the rationale that the district court adopted when looking at this.
And Judge Stadtmuller did not reach the exclusion issues, did he?
That's correct, Your Honor. Judge Stadtmuller found that there was no occurrence or bodily injury caused by an accident. Therefore, he didn't think that he needed to go into an analysis of the exclusions. If this court does find that there's a reason to go into the exclusions or isn't sure about whether or not there is an accident alleged in the complaint, we believe that both the intentional acts exclusion and the employee-related liability exclusion applies. Most significantly, I would like to talk for just a minute about the intentional acts exclusion. Everyone agrees that there's a two-pronged test when you look at the intentional acts exclusion. Number one is there some sort of an intentional act? I don't think there's any dispute by anyone that the complaint in this case alleges some type of an intentional act. The second prong when you're looking at the intentional acts exclusion is whether or not there is some intent to cause an injury. Now, I think if you look at the complaint, you can conclude, the clear language of the complaint requires you to conclude, that an intent to injure is stated in the complaint. You know, paragraph 22 says intentional infliction of emotional distress. I mean, emotional distress is an injury, and the complaint is saying that there's an intent to cause that injury. Paragraph 10 talks about the plaintiff being forcibly transported from to this business meeting. Paragraph 22 talks about deliberately withholding medical treatment. Paragraph 19 talks about intentional termination. Those are intentional acts that are intended to cause an injury. I mean, no one terminates a person's employment without intending to cause an injury. I mean, you terminate them, you know that they're going to stop getting paid. You know that they're going to stop getting their benefits. That is intending an injury. Even if the court doesn't believe that those paragraphs do state an actual intent to injure, the court is allowed to infer an intent to injure. Specifically, the insured is presumed to intend the natural and probable consequences of his or her actions. Once again, the natural and probable consequence of terminating a person's employment is that they're going to sustain losses. They're going to sustain wage losses, loss of benefits, maybe other losses. The natural and probable consequence of intentionally inflicting emotional distress is causing emotional distress. So if you look at particularly the A.O. Smith case, which talks about what type of presumption can the court make and when can the court presume that there's harm, you can see that the allegations in this complaint clearly fall within that standard. Now, I know in their briefing, the other side has alleged that the only cases in Wisconsin that talk about this intentional acts exclusion are criminal cases. And there are sexual assault cases that talk about it. There are cases about corpse being shot that talk about it. But the A.O. Smith case and the Bruner case, the two cases that we cite primarily in our brief, those are civil cases. Now, A.O. Smith does involve some sort of a conspiracy claim, but it's a civil conspiracy, and Bruner's a civil conversion claim. So this rationale, this assuming, presuming the probable consequences of your actions, isn't something that's just limited to criminal cases, certainly not just limited to sexual assault cases. In conclusion, I just would like to point out that in both the intentional acts exclusion cases and the cases that talk about what is an occurrence and what is an accident, several times the court uses the example of, you know, a person firing a gun into a crowd, and that person says, well, I don't intend to cause injury to anyone. The court says, but that's not a reasonable intention. I mean, if you're firing a gun into a crowd, you are expected, the unexpected result is not an accident. Now, in this case, the plaintiff's whole argument is that even though the complaint alleges specific intentional acts, that the unintended result is that this caused an injury. And the case law simply doesn't support that type of conclusion. What the case law requires is that you look at the allegations contained in the complaint. If the allegations contained in the complaint are for intentional acts, then the court has to conclude that there is no insurance coverage. That is exactly what the trial court or the district court concluded in this case. They said that the insurance contracts in this case do not provide coverage because the allegations in the complaint are for intentional acts. And because of that, we ask this court to affirm the district court's ruling. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Strang. Mr. Langhoff. Thank you.
Thank you. Let me respond to a number of the points made by Mr. Strappin. First, he indicates that you can only look at the allegations in the complaint to determine duty to defend, which is true, but it's half true, because what's not in the complaint also needs to be considered. Not necessarily what deposition testimony demonstrated or what other evidence demonstrated, but if a fact is not in the complaint, that's a significant fact. And so, as I told you before, the facts that are in the complaint are just as important as those that are not in the complaint, and vice versa. And here it is important to know what's not in the complaint. And those facts that I said before are very significant because it demonstrates that under no circumstances did Mr. Armbrust have any reason to believe or intend any harm from taking somebody to a business meeting. Mr. Strampy talks about shooting a gun and fraud and conspiracy and criminal conduct. Where are those facts in this case? This is not a criminal, Mr. Armbrust. There's no criminal allegations. This is a businessman who's the president of his company who drives an employee, a high-level employee, to a business meeting for 2 hours and then is good enough afterwards to help the guy to his car and to drive him to a hospital. Where are these bad facts? Mr. Strampy talks about termination of employment. The reason I didn't mention that is because that is not germane to this appeal. As the Wisconsin case law is clear on the point, if any one particular claim in any pleading is arguably covered, the insurer has a duty to defend all of the claims. We have three policies here. If there's any one claim, and that's the reason I focused on the facts I did earlier, that fall within arguable coverage, there's a duty to defend. And that's what happened here. So I'm not here to talk about wrongful termination or intentional termination. I'm here to talk about driving somebody to a business meeting and being sued for it. You got to understand that there's two policies here, essentially, that are relevant. One is a CGL policy, a general liability policy. The other is an employer's liability policy. Those two policies are intended to cover general claims and employee claims. The insurers want to have it both ways. For example, on the employment-related practices exclusion, they want to say, well, under these policies, the CGL policy, it's an employment-related practice. But it's not an employment-related practice over here under the employer's liability policy. And they can't have it both ways. It either is or it isn't. just like with the intentional conduct here. It either is intentional in terms of harm or it's not. This three-phase process of analysis is just not in the case law. If you read the Patrick case, they say right out, he intended to cut the trees, he intended to cut those trees. He didn't intend any harm. There's an occurrence. You are absolutely correct that there is a difference in occurrence language in the policies. The umbrella policy and the CGL policy uses the word occurrence. The employer's liability policy does not. They're drafted by the same company. Federal issued both of those policies. If Federal intended occurrence to be in both policies, they would have wrote it in. It's their language. What the policy says, the employer's liability policy, is it covers bodily injury by accident. Does accident qualify injury? I think so. At least I think it's arguable that it does. If they meant for it to quantify an act, they would have wrote, we're talking about acts. They didn't do that. It's their language, and they're stuck with it. They can make it clear, and I don't understand what's so difficult about this. If their position as it is, they tell the court, why can't they simply write a policy so an insured can understand it? Why can't they write a policy to say, if an occurrence is only an unintended act, regardless of the intentional nature of the harm?
Thank you, Mr. Lai. Our thanks to both counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.